Robert Caro has spent nearly 40 years working on his monumental biography of President Lyndon Johnson, and he's still not done. So far, he's weighed in with 3,400 pages in the four volumes he's published, and he's just barely made it to the years LBJ was president. Caro's most recent volume, called The Passage to Power, tells the remarkable story of how Johnson became president after suffering through one of the worst vice presidencies in American history.
Because when he's vice president, he's so powerless, he's despised by the Kennedy people. They have a nickname for him, Rufus Cornpone. They call him and Lady Bird, his wife, Uncle Rufus and his little pork chop. Oh. And then in an instant, in the crack of a gunshot in Dallas, he's elevated to be the most powerful man in the Western world.
That crack of a gunshot, and everything changes. But really, before we can go on to talk about how everything changed, we can't ignore the Johnson of your first three volumes. He was the master of the Senate. How did he allow himself to get into the position of being vice president?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. In 1958, as you say, he's the Senate majority leader. He's called the second most powerful man in the country after only President Eisenhower. He is the most powerful and effective Senate leader in history. He's actually made the Senate work. The Senate before him was the same, believe it or not, the same mess it's in today. But for the 6 years, 1955 through 1961, that he was majority leader, the Senate really worked. So he thinks in 1958 that he's going to have the Democratic nomination. He doesn't realize that this young senator, Jack Kennedy, is running around the country, brilliant politician, great speechmaker, rounding up delegates. Before Johnson realizes it, it's too late, and Kennedy has taken the nomination away from him. Then Kennedy offers him the vice presidency. And, you know, if you become vice president, you're no longer a sectional politician. You're a national figure. He calculates this. He actually has his staff people look up how many presidents have died in office.
Oh, my.
And it comes out to one out of six. And someone asks him why he takes the vice presidency. And he actually says to them, he says to a lot of people the same thing. Well, six of them didn't have to get elected.
Again, he's so smart. He does all this calculation. He looks into everything. He checks all the facts. Why did he so misunderstand JFK? He really didn't think much of the Kennedy brothers, did he?
He certainly doesn't think much of Jack Kennedy. This great reader of men had read one man wrong, and the man was Jack Kennedy. And I think a big part of the reason is that when Kennedy's in the Senate, he's young, he's still very sick, he's had these two horrible back operations. Although he keeps smiling, no one really knows it, he's always in pain. And Johnson was to say about him as a senator, this is a quote from Lyndon Johnson, he was pathetic. And Johnson sees this sickly young man, and that's what he calls him. He says he was sickly. He actually said of Jack Kennedy, he's not a man's man. So he underestimates him completely.
Well, on top of that, there's bad blood already with the other Kennedy brother, with Bobby.
Well, with Robert Kennedy, there's absolute hatred. These are two people who just can't stand each other in a chemical way. And, of course, at the convention, after Jack Kennedy offers Lyndon Johnson the presidency, Robert Kennedy comes down three times to Johnson's room to try to persuade him to withdraw from the ticket. And Johnson was to hate him for that for the rest of his life.
Was there some particular incident, or is it just, as you say, chemistry?
The first time they meet, it's in the Senate cafeteria. Lyndon Johnson had breakfast in the Senate cafeteria, which was on the second floor of the Senate office building, every morning with some of his aides. And Senator Joe McCarthy had breakfast there every morning at the same time at a big table near the cashier's register with four or five of his aides. One morning, Johnson comes in, and there's a new aide at Joe McCarthy's table, and it's Robert Kennedy, then a 27-year-old, very slight, boyish-looking figure. You know, McCarthy jumps up, as all senators did, in deference to the leader, and his staff people all jump up. McCarthy is saying, basically, you know, good morning, leader, wonderful job yesterday, Mr. Leader, anything I can do for you, leader. And Johnson shakes his hand in the hands of the staff members. But one McCarthy staff member doesn't get up. and he's Robert Kennedy, and it's deliberate. And Johnson walks over to him. Johnson knew how to handle this situation. And he sort of extends his hand halfway so that Robert Kennedy has to get up to take his hand. And one of Johnson's staff people who was with him said to me, I asked him why this happened. He said, did you ever see two dogs that didn't know each other come into a room and suddenly there's a low growl and the hair rises on the back of their necks? There was something between those two men that they just hated each other. All the time that Robert Kennedy is a staff member in the Senate, Johnson calls him, goes out of his way to call him Sonny Boy.
Well, that brings us back to the convention and why Robert went down three times to try to persuade Johnson to leave the ticket. But what he didn't know, I gather, was that John really wanted Johnson, not because he liked him, but because he needed him.
Well, he certainly did need him. You know, Lyndon Johnson does a great job of campaigning. People forget, President Eisenhower, not the Democrat, but President Eisenhower, the Republican, had carried Texas in 1952 and 1956. In 1956, he carried Texas by over 200,000 votes. No Democratic candidate is going to win for president in 1960 if he doesn't carry Texas. So Jack Kennedy basically goes down in the morning after his nomination, meets alone with Lyndon Johnson, and although there is not a firm understanding, both Johnson knows he's been offered it, and Kennedy believes he's going to take it. He comes back up to his suite, and there's a bunch of northern bosses there who can all count votes and know he has to have Texas, and he says it looks like he's going to take it. And they all shake his hand and congratulations.
There must have been days in the years to come when Lyndon Johnson wished he had pulled his name off the ticket and gone away, because they didn't let him do anything, did they?
No, the Kennedys cut him out pretty completely. You know, Johnson is the greatest legislator of the second half of the 20th century. He can get bills through Congress like no one else. Yet he once was to say that Kennedy's legislative aide, Lawrence O'Brien, he says in 2 years he never once asked me for a piece of advice. The Kennedys mock him. They insult him to his face sometimes. They won't call him Mr. Vice President, some of them. They keep calling him Lyndon, which he hates. And these are years of humiliation for him that are so painful that it's sort of sad to write about him.
And then the assassination and the return to Washington, and all of a sudden he has everything he'd ever wished for.
Yes, that about sums it up.
Well, then he does get back, and he immediately goes into full LBJ mode, I guess. The thing that's surprising to me, in a way, is that he decided to put on a display of presidential power, and he'd used it to get civil rights legislation out of committee and enacted. Why do you think he chose that in particular?
Well, you know, Lyndon Johnson had always wanted to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. I write in this book about how when he was only 20 years old, he's going to this little college in the midst of the hill country. He doesn't even have enough money for that. Johnson's very poor, has to drop out of college for a year. And during that year, he teaches school to earn money at a little town called Catula, which is below San Antonio on the way to the Rio Grande River. And he teaches in what's called the Mexican school there. And the children who he taught there recall how insistent he was that they learn English. He thought that was very important for them, how hard he tried to instill ambition in them. Now he's suddenly president. He has to give his first speech to Congress. Kennedy's civil rights bill has been stalled in Congress. Congress has really stopped it completely. And the night before he has to give the speech, it's either the third or the fourth night after the assassination, a group of his speechwriters, as his advisors, are gathered around Johnson's kitchen table in his home. He still hasn't moved into the White House. And they're all saying to him, don't emphasize civil rights. Don't use up your political capital on civil rights. The Southerners control Congress. All you're going to do is alienate them and put your whole program in jeopardy. It's a noble cause, civil rights, but it's a lost cause. And you know what Johnson says? He says, well, what's the presidency for then? And in his speech, he says, the first and most important thing we have to do is to pass Jack Kennedy's civil rights bill. He says to one of his speechwriters later, speaking of the kids in Cotulla, I swore then if I ever had the power to help those kids, I was going to do it. Now I have the power, and I'll tell you a secret, I mean to use it. Lyndon Johnson and civil rights is a thrilling story.
That's biographer Robert Caro. The fourth volume of his study of LBJ is called The Passage to Power.
You have the chance never before afforded to any people in any age. You can help build a society where the demands of morality and the needs of the spirit can be realized in the life of the nation. So will you join in the battle to give every citizen the full equality which God enjoins and the law requires, whatever his belief or race or the color of his skin?
President Lyndon Johnson speaking at the University of Michigan in May of 1964.